This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, June 15th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. This season's Shakespeare in the Park features a production of Julius Caesar with Caesar as Trump. After a video of the assassination scene went viral, two sponsors, Delta Airlines and Bank of America, pulled their funding, declaring that the production was intended to, quote, provoke and offend. On Monday, before the show's opening night, Oscar Eustace, the artistic director of The Public and the director of the show, got on stage to explain what he had in mind.
Hamlet said the purpose of playing from the first till today was and is to hold up, as 'twere, a mirror to nature, to show the age his form and pressure. Excuse the male pronoun, it's what he used. That's what we do here in the theater. We try to hold a mirror up to nature. It's what Shakespeare was doing, it's what we're doing. When we hold the mirror up to nature, often what we reveal are disturbing, upsetting, provoking things. Thank God, that's our job.
Rebecca Mead joins me to discuss the controversy surrounding the production and what political theater on and off stage looks like in the Trump era. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure to be here.
I've wanted to get you on for a long time, and now we are able to talk about art for once as well as politics. You saw the play. Can you talk a little bit about its portrayal of Caesar?
Yeah. The whole setting of the play is contemporary. So the very opening is activists who are sort of like maybe Black Lives Matter. There's someone wearing Dorothy Munkesson's little jacket. And contemporary protest movement scene. So we're set, established in the contemporary world. When Caesar appears, he comes from the back of the stage forward in a way that is reminiscent of Trump's entry at the Republican convention.
And he's wearing
dark blue suit, and he's wearing a red tie, and he has a bouffant blonde hair, and he's raising his arms in the air in victory above his head, and his fingers are outstretched so that even if the actor's fingers aren't actually stubby, they sort of look stubby. He's managing to perform stubbiness. And it's really funny.
And does the audience immediately respond?
Oh, the audience was immediately responsive, and a combination of shock and delight and a kind of frisson of excitement that we were going to see something replaying in art, something that we're living every day, every minute. I don't mean by that that we were all looking forward to the assassination, although you know it's coming, so you wonder how it's going to be handled. But the opportunity that the play and this production gives the audience for reliving the present in a cathartic way. I mean, Julius Caesar has often and always been played for contemporary relevance. It's not at all unusual to set the production in a contemporary setting. I saw a couple of years ago a Royal Shakespeare Company production that set Julius Caesar in contemporary Africa, and it all felt really relevant and really, really alive.
And what about the assassination scene?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the audience knows that the assassination is coming, and one's watching, wondering how this is going to play out, and also wondering how the rest of the audience is going to behave. When it does happen, it's performed with knives, and it's very bloody. The white shirt that Caesar is wearing is very quickly sodden with blood, and it's a butchery. It's a horrible thing to witness. And the audience, when I saw it, was dead, dead silent. There was no sense that this was something we should be hoping for or waiting for or longing for. It was to show how terribly wrong a response to tyranny, more tyranny, is.
There was this immediate outrage on the right, and Donald Trump Jr. was one of those, and he tweeted over the weekend after the video went viral, "When does art become political speech?" What about that question? Is that the wrong question to be asking? Is there some legitimacy in it?
I mean, you could argue that art ought to be political and that art often is political, and the ways in which art permits us to address political questions gives us a space to consider ideas outside of the framework of the usual political discourse.
Also worth noting that, as the New York Times mentioned earlier this week, there was a traveling production of the play with Obama as Julius Caesar.
Well, there's an error, isn't there, in thinking that what goes on stage is advocacy for what might or should go on offstage. And I mean, any sophisticated viewer of theatrical work, or even not so sophisticated viewer, knows that what we're seeing is show, is drama. It isn't political advocacy, at least not in a straightforward way. You know, you can understand, taken out of context, you know, yes, it's horrifying to see somebody slaughtered on stage.
Well,
it's supposed to be horrifying.
Unfortunately, that's exactly how the vast majority of people are going to be responding to this online, on social media, the clip taken out of context.
That's true. That doesn't mean that the production shouldn't have been
done
as it was, of course.
Yesterday, five Republican members of Congress were shot at during a baseball practice. Steve Scalise, the majority whip, is critically wounded. The gunman was a fanatic supporter of Bernie Sanders and made threatening comments on social media about Trump and the Republican Party. Trump did say the right thing about the country coming together, but Donald Trump Jr. retweeted the comment, quote, "Events like yesterday are exactly why we took issue with New York elites glorifying the assassination of our president." I want to hear you talk just a little bit more about these moments when politics and art collide.
Well, one of the things that I've been thinking about in the wake of this controversy over the play and then this shooting yesterday is that the part of the play that perhaps we should be focusing more of our attention upon is Mark Antony's speech to the mob.
And remind us about that.
Well, Mark Antony is an ally of Caesar and, after the assassination, is permitted by the plotters and by the assassins to speak to the crowd at Caesar's funeral, and is told he can do so with the understanding that he will not say anything negative about the conspirators. And of course, the speech itself is a masterpiece of rhetorical persuasion. Mark Antony does not say anything negative about the conspirators. What he does through this speech is whip up the audience, who have been persuaded by the conspirators that it was the right thing to do to kill Caesar, and turns them. The ways in which the American mob can be incited to violence or to the endorsing violence is something that worries me far more than the artistic depiction of an assassination.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Right after the election, Mike Pence went to see Hamilton. You were one of the first ones, I think the first one, to write about that show. Could you talk a little bit about why you think it's been a runaway hit and how it takes its own extraordinary artistic liberties with an historic figure?
It takes liberties with the historical story in ways that, you know, historians could enumerate the, you know, elisions of certain elections and placing, you know, three people in a room who were never in the room together and all those kinds of things. I mean, it condenses history and transforms it slightly in order to create a shapely narrative. What it does most radically isn't so much altering American history as seeing it through a different prism. And the ways in which Hamilton presented the founding fathers and the founding mothers as people of color singing in the language of today, and especially in the language of young people today. You know, Lin-Manuel Miranda started writing Hamilton around about the time of Obama's first election. And it resonated when it opened 2 years ago with the kind of hope and optimism that that election had given so many of us in this country. In the light of Trump's election, Hamilton takes on a very different cast, because one of the themes of the show is how risky it is to establish democracy and how easily things might have gone otherwise. One of the things that Hamilton does is suggest to us the ways in which American history only came about in the way that it did because of the radical acts of a bunch of young guys who were not afraid to take risks. That's the suggestion. That's why it's a hip-hop story.
I was thinking, after the horrible events of yesterday and also the response to Julius Caesar, what happened after Mike Pence went to see Hamilton? And after the musical was over, members of the cast directly addressed him.
Vice President-elect Pence, we welcome you and we truly thank you for joining us here at Hamilton, an American Musical. We really do. We are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us. Our planet, our children, our parents, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. But we truly hope that this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us. All of us.
Trump immediately tweeted, demanding an apology. But Pence, when he was asked about it on Fox News Sunday, said of the boos and cheers that he was greeted with as he walked into the theater, "I nudged my kids and reminded them that's what freedom sounds like." And what an amazing response. And I wish I were hearing more of that from Mike Pence these days. But,
you know, the idea that artists shouldn't be allowed to say anything that offends is absurd and ridiculous. And the idea that corporations can be cowed into withdrawing their support from artists when they know full well that the public theater is going to do something that's pushing the boundaries, politically speaking.
As Eustace says, this is what we do.
It's what the public theater's always done. It's what they've built their reputation on. It's why many of their supporters give them money.
You could also argue that at times like this, it opens up discussions. And I thought of you again today because you wrote another piece about another great work of art by Margaret Atwood not so long ago, whose dystopian novel, The Handmaid's Tale, was recently adapted into a popular TV series. It's set in the near future, not in the past, in a United States that has been overthrown by a totalitarian theocracy hell-bent on oppressing women. And it has become, again, a huge bestseller. And you talked a little bit to Margaret Atwood about that and about what she had in mind when she wrote the novel and how people are responding to it now. What did she say about that?
You know, I mean, Margaret Atwood herself has written in the last several months op-eds in which she's reflected upon the timeliness of the story once again. The part of The Handmaid's Tale that has come back to me in the last day since this shooting is the section in which there's a little backstory given as to how this theocracy came to take power. I'll read a passage from the book. It's the handmaid is narrating. She's describing when things went from weird but okay to the dystopian picture that we are now seeing represented on our TV screens every week. She says, "It was after the catastrophe, when they shot the president and machine-gunned the Congress and the army declared a state of emergency. They blamed it on the Islamic fanatics at the time." There's this suggestion that there's a precipitating disaster that happens in this world that allows this theocratic government to take over. And a lot of us have been watching and wondering when or whether something is going to happen in this country that allows the president and the administration to clamp down upon free speech and upon all those other rights that we feel that we have enshrined but maybe don't.
And it's a spark that Trump himself helped to light throughout his campaign. And I wondered, what do you make of the political theater that Trump manufactures? You know, he is a student of Hollywood. Much as he deplores, and although the right-wingers deplore much of the liberal elite in New York and in Hollywood, he's a master at the form. He staged his rallies, you know, with his audiences very much in mind. His complaints about fake news, all of this has led to an effect where he's created his own reality.
I think a lot of us wake up every day and read the news as if we were getting the latest updates on some really compelling but terrifying high-quality TV. The political scene is something that one watches unfold like a play or like a, you know, I mean, he's a showman, but he's a demonic one. I mean, there's something so compelling and terrifying about the performance.
So, Rebecca, I want to end with Shakespeare, but perhaps
what a good place to
but
go.
Perhaps you reading Shakespeare. What is your favorite passage in the play? Julius Caesar.
Well, this speech of Mark Antony's, which is a very famous speech, and it's the point that turns the mob against the overthrowers of Caesar. You know, everybody knows the first couple of lines of the speech. It's, you know, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. When I was 16, I could have given you the whole speech right there. It builds and swells and persuades the crowd to change their minds without realizing that they're changing their minds, which is what great oratory does. And the passage I've been thinking of here is the culmination of Antony's speech. It begins, "Good friends, sweet friends, let me not stir you up to such a sudden flood of mutiny. They that have done this deed are honorable. What private griefs they have, alas, I know not, that made them do it. They are wise and honorable, and will, no doubt, with reasons answer you. I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. I am no orator, as Brutus is, but, as you know me all, a plain, blunt man that love my friend, and that they know full well that gave me public leave to speak of him. For I have neither wit, nor words, nor worth, action, nor utterance, nor the power of speech to stir men's blood. I only speak right on. I tell you that which you yourselves do know. Show you sweet Caesar's wounds, poor, poor, dumb mouths, and bid them speak for me. But were I Brutus and Brutus Antony, there were an Antony would ruffle up your spirits and put a tongue in every wound of Caesar that should move the stones of Rome to rise and mutiny."
Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Mead is a staff writer and the author of My Life in Middlemarch. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review the program on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for newyorker.com with help from Hannibal Lentz. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.